story of Thanksgiving. Black top hats and buckled shoes are the first things that have to go in any real effort to paint an accurate picture of the settlers we have since come to call the Pilgrims. In fact, the name Pilgrims should probably also go. The community aboard the Mayflower actually referred to themselves as first comers or saints. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, we're going to hear from Kenneth Davis, best-selling author of the Don't Know Much About History books. He'll give us the real history of the origins of Thanksgiving. Who were the Pilgrims? What was life aboard the Mayflower really like? We'll also learn more about the relationship that the settlers of Plymouth had with local native tribes, and with one Indian in particular, whose assistance may have allowed them to survive. The origins of Thanksgiving, today on Maine Calling. First, this news. From the MPBN studios in Bangor, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Tomorrow, many of us will gather with family and friends to eat turkey, cranberry, and stuffing, watch some football, complain about holiday shopping, and begin thinking about what to do with all of that leftover food. But just how much do you really know about Thanksgiving? Who decided we should celebrate this holiday, and why? I'm fortunate to have with me in the studio today Kenneth Davis. He's the best-selling author of Don't Know Much About History, which spent 35 consecutive weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. He's spoken at the Smithsonian Museum and American Museum of Natural History, has written for the New York Times and Newsday, among other notable publications. He's also contributed to NPR's All Things Considered. Ken Davis, welcome to Maine Calling.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Keith. Thanks for having me.
And of course, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about this holiday event that we call Thanksgiving? Our number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Ken Davis, I, like many people of my generation, kind of grew up being fed this conventional version of the history of Thanksgiving, which was centered around, of course, this group of people we called the Pilgrims. But as we said at the top, the Pilgrims didn't call themselves the Pilgrims, which means that maybe we should review our history of this whole history all over again and take a second look at it, and which is what you've done here. But let's start with the Pilgrims, as we call them. Who were they, and what were they trying to achieve?
Well, Keith, with this story, we have perhaps the greatest example in American history, which has a lot of myths and legends and lore draped around it. Perhaps no holiday from our past is draped in more mythology, misconception, legend, and lore than Thanksgiving. And it is the quintessential American holiday now. But the story is truly fascinating. But let's start with those Pilgrims. They did not wear those clunky black hats and black shoes with buckles. It was a much later depiction of what Puritans looked like, and we'll come to back to the difference between a Pilgrim and a Puritan. When we talk about the Pilgrims, we're essentially talking about 102 people who sailed on the Mayflower, but even then, only half of them were what we would call Pilgrims, people who were coming to America, the New World, looking for religious freedom. These were people who were essentially a fairly small sect of separatists, meaning they wanted to break away from the Church of England, which had broken away from the Church of Rome under Henry VIII, of course. And the Pilgrims, what we call the Pilgrims, the separatists, really didn't think that the Church of England had gone far enough in purifying itself of all of the terrible things that the Church of Rome did. And so they had moved initially to Holland, felt that their children were there quite a while, felt that their children were growing up learning more about Dutch than English traditions and learning to speak Dutch, and so decided instead to start all over in this new land, and they had the opportunity to come to America. But as I said, only about half of those 102 passengers on the Mayflower sailing in 1620 in late September were actually those separatists. The other half were indentured servants, people who had purchased an opportunity to come to this new world and make a new start, and in some case hired help, including perhaps one of the most famous of them, Miles Standish, who was essentially the defense ministry of the pilgrims. He was, I guess you would call him a soldier for hire, a mercenary soldier. And so very different picture than just a bunch of people who were coming to America for their religious freedom.
And they really, though, did believe in this religious mission so much that they were willing to undertake this voyage. The Mayflower, this was not a fun trip, and some of the details that you chronicle about what life was like aboard the Mayflower is really hard to take. But talk about that, if you will.
66 days aboard, and it was not a cruise, needless to say. First of all, the passengers, because crew didn't want especially children, there were about 35 children on board the Mayflower. The crew didn't want kids running around on deck. It was unsafe and a nuisance. So all those 102 passengers were really confined to below decks. We don't know exactly how big the Mayflower was, but probably about 90 feet long, stem to stern. Not a lot of space for 102 people, plus their laundry, plus their things they had brought for starting a new colony in the New World, plus pigs, sheep, chickens, dogs, cats, as well as the mice and rats that were on board.
And fleas.
And fleas and lice. It was, and of course, we're not talking about people who bathed under ordinary circumstances for the most part, but they certainly didn't bathe on board the Mayflower. So 66 days with the pigs and the chickens underground, under decks, must have been gotten pretty ripe. And of course, the North Atlantic in the fall is stormy. It was a treacherous voyage. They had actually started out with more ships, which started to leak, so they combined into the one ship, being the Mayflower. So it was a treacherous voyage. By the end of it, as they were getting to November, they were expecting to go sail much further south to what was then the Virginia colony, an established colony, had been established much earlier, but stopped instead not originally at Plymouth, but at what we now think of as Cape Cod.
And they actually explored the coastline a bit before they settled in Plymouth.
They spent a good deal of time wandering around Cape Cod looking for a suitable settlement spot. They were unable to find just the right sort of situation that they wanted, which was something with a bit of a hill to be a defensive position, enough fresh water nearby, a good bay in which to actually anchor the Mayflower for a while. So they explored for quite a bit, found some corn buried, curiously, buried by, obviously, American Indians, and helped themselves to it. There's some question about whether they agreed that they would pay for it later on, but that was one of the bits and pieces that gets left out of the story. But they're there for a couple of weeks before deciding that this doesn't offer the right situation, and they sail on a little bit further and find what we now think of as Plymouth.
I also was curious about there's a section in your book here about what they did when they finally, after this voyage of not being able to bathe for weeks and weeks and weeks and being hungry and cold and tired, what they did when they landed.
Well, pray. They were really religious people, the pilgrims, and not very festive about their religion either, of course, and that plays itself out further. These were not people who celebrated. They were convinced that they were all sinners and doomed to die and burn in hell fire. So praying, about the most festive thing a pilgrim would do would be sing some psalms, and that would be a good night's entertainment. So it's not a happy group. also not the dour, completely, you know, strict group that we think of, because, as I mentioned, half of them were not truly pilgrims. And that becomes an issue when they actually do land then and decide what's going to happen next.
Right. So the non-pilgrims, and by the way, as we said also, they didn't call themselves pilgrims. They referred to themselves as the first comers.
The first comers was later on when they actually referred to themselves as saints. How modest. And the non-pilgrims were called strangers. And they would have included people like Miles Standish, who was essentially a hired gun. Or a hired sword, at least.
And as you say, when they land, there's some tensions, because the people who are not part of the religious community want to kind of go off and do their own thing.
Right. And again, it's important to realize that they were supposed to go further south, where they would have been under the control of the existing Virginia colony. But by staying as far north as they did in an area that was outside of the Virginia charter, they were essentially on their own. So how were they going to decide things? And actually, before they even get to Plymouth, once they do arrive at the tip of Cape Cod, they do decide in November of 1620 that they're going to have some rudimentary form of government, of how we're going to decide things. And it's at that moment that they decide upon what we call the Mayflower Compact, which is remarkable because it was, in a sense, a fundamental, very rudimentary constitution guaranteeing democracy, that there would be votes on things. Of course, it was going to be limited to adult males, but it was this first stepping stone towards American democracy.
The first time that an English colonist had elected their own leader.
Colonist. Yeah, the House of Burgesses existed in Virginia earlier in 1619, but that was still a group of that was under a royal charter. These were people who were basically saying, we're going to rule ourselves. Of course, they would still be under the royal control of England, but still a rather remarkable statement.
So they settle here, they start building houses, the women sleep on the ship, on the boat, on the Mayflower, to be safe from what the concern was, local natives.
They were mostly concerned at that point, certainly about the local natives, the American Indians. And this is a large part of the mythology. And certainly the reason that they chose the Plymouth spot was that it was, in fact, an abandoned Native American village. And they land there. The men come ashore. Everyone comes ashore, but it's determined that the men will build a single common house that they will stay in on land, and the women will remain on the Mayflower and do for 3 months. And we're talking about arriving, of course, in December 1620, a particularly bad time to decide to start a new colony, obviously, in New England. Massachusetts in December, as we all know here, can be rather rigorous. So it was ill-conceived, perhaps, but still an extraordinary moment. They do decide to choose this abandoned Indian village. There were clearly signs that people had lived there at some point, because it has the fresh water. It is a somewhat defensible position. There's plenty of seafood right there available, so one was going to be able to, if not hunt and trap, at least fish. So for 3 months, the women stay on the Mayflower, and the men start to develop the colony by building one single shared house.
And I think history, even the conventional history that we are given in school, did tell us that it was a rough winter and that many of these colonists died in that first
winter. It's beyond rough. I mean, half of the Mayflower passengers die in the first year. So that by the time we get to October and this Thanksgiving Day, that as we call it, their number is vastly reduced. One of the things they did, we know, is that they would bury the dead at night to conceal the fact that their numbers were falling so drastically. They wanted to try and hide from any local Indians, the local natives who might be watching, and warily watching what was going on, that their numbers were falling. But disease, malnutrition, exposure, all of these took a heavy toll. Death during childbirth, obviously, under these circumstances, was part of this as well. By the way, one child born on the Mayflower in Passage, a child named Oceanus, and another child born once the Mayflower is at anchored, named Peregrine, and considered the first child born in Pilgrim North America.
Yeah, and I think in your book, Peregrine means wanderer, but the irony there is that this person never left
much further than a few miles from Plymouth.
We're going to take a break in a second here, but tell us about the first Indian that there are no major events here, even though the pilgrims are nervous, having heard stories when they were in Holland about the Indians and the potential dangers. But there really are no incidents, and then they have their first meeting.
We have to remember that there were Englishmen in Virginia, and they had been established there quite a while, and there had been tremendous fights between the Indians, the American Indians in Virginia, and the Virginia colonists, some real deadly fights, so that there was tremendous misgiving about what to expect if they should meet anyone. One of the myths or misconceptions, we should come back to this, is that there had been no Europeans in this part of the world before. Certainly there were, and of course that's why one day in March, a half-naked, tattered Indian walks into camp and speaks a few words of English. He is known as Samoset. A few days later, he brings back another native who speaks even better English, whose name has come down to us as Squanto, probably more something like Tisquantum. And his story is part of this tale.
Yeah, and he had actually, his English was good because he'd actually been to England.
He'd been taken as a slave aboard English ships and had lived for 5 years and was trying in those 5 years to get back to his own village. And it was that village where the pilgrims had decided to land. It was abandoned, emptied, because Squanto's people had been wiped out by some kind of epidemic disease, most likely introduced by Europeans who had arrived earlier. And that's part of the story.
Yeah, which all contributes to really this myth that's busted, that somehow the pilgrims, as we call them, were the first to arrive. There's this historical myth that they came to this territory untouched by Europeans.
That no one had ever seen a European before. Well, there had been primarily cod fishermen sailing up and down these coasts for a very long time, both Portuguese and English. It was a rich fishing area. They would stop and dry the cod on the banks, the shores of New England, as it would be called. And so there was tremendous contact already, and it's probably that contact between the American Indians who were in the Northeast at that time and these European fishermen that introduced those diseases that most likely wiped out tens of thousands of Native Americans before the pilgrims even arrived.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we want to hear from you. We'll also continue the true history, the true story of Thanksgiving. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Cross Jewelers, helping Maine celebrate the holidays for more than 100 years. Open Saturdays through Christmas, upstairs in downtown Portland, or crossjewelers.com. By Casella, committed to increasing recycling rates while reducing residential trash and landfill loads through zero-sort recycling. Casella, giving resources new life. And Revision Energy, committed to helping Maine communities go solar from Kittery to Bangor, from Bar Harbor to Bethel. More at revisionenergy.com.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Be sure to join us for Turkey Confidential, culinary triage on the day you need it most, Thanksgiving. We're here to take your calls with some help from Jacques Pepin and Andrew Zimmern. Don't miss it. That's Turkey Confidential, live Thanksgiving Day from 8 p.m.
join us tomorrow afternoon from noon to 2 here on MPBN Radio.
Next time on The World, the Paris suburb of Épinay has 50,000 residents and no place for young people to go on a Sunday night except for this McDonald's. Young people here say they are shocked by the recent attacks, but they understand the circumstances that led people from their generation, from suburbs like theirs, to turn to violence. Young, French, and on the edge on The World.
That's ahead at 3 o'clock this afternoon here on MPBN.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, The Hidden History of Thanksgiving. With me in our Bangor studios, Ken Davis. He's the best-selling author of Don't Know Much About History series of books. And we invite you to join the conversation as well. The number is 800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We left off before the break with the arrival of Squanto, as he became known. Why is he such an important figure in this story, and how does he contribute to the actual survival of this colony?
As I mentioned, Keith, first of all, he's able to speak English and speak English well. Samoset's English was much more halting. He had only had a little interaction with some of those fishermen and traders, as I mentioned, who had been in the area long before the pilgrims arrived. But Squanto has come back to his village in hopes of reconnecting with his people after this 5 years spent on English ships, which is where he learned his English, hoping to reestablish where find his own family. And of course, he finds that his village has been wiped out, again, epidemic disease. So he becomes connected with another tribe that is in the area, and it's that tribe who Squanto then introduces eventually to the pilgrims, led by someone who's come down to us as Massasoit. But it was really Squanto who sees that has an affinity for the English, and he does begin to teach them some of the tricks of how to survive in this very, very brutal still winter when it's March when he meets them, so it's going to go into the planting season. He certainly teaches them about planting corn and how to do it successfully. So their survival is completely dependent upon his role. As he then introduces them to others of the local tribe, the Massasoit tribe, they agree to a kind of treaty, I guess we would call it, or at least an alliance where the English will help Massasoit people against any other Native American tribes. And this is part of the other complexity of the story. We like to think that, oh, there were Indians here. Well, there were many, many tribes, many, many nations, and the pilgrims clearly made an alliance, a defense alliance of sort, with one of those tribes and battled other tribes at the same time. So it's a much more nuanced, complicated story, which is what makes it so interesting. Many of the things we're talking about, I discussed in a book I had written for children called Don't Know Much About the Pilgrims, but the bigger, richer story of this is also told in Don't Know Much About History, as well as one of my books called America's Hidden History, which really talks about this whole episode as one of those untold tales, the stories that our school books do leave out.
And of course, later on, the relationship with Indians goes somewhat south in a significant way. But for this meantime, though, there is a real mutual relationship that goes on to the point where, though, it's almost too good, and that Indians are kind of showing up at the colony looking for food, and it becomes a problem.
It does become a problem, and it was a little bit nervous-making because the relationship, while basically fundamentally peaceful, was still very tenuous. You know, what do we really expect from these people? We being the pilgrims, when I say that, and so it's a very, very uneasy relationship, and there are clearly cases where they are going to fight other tribes, and there are actually incidents in the life of Miles Standish, for instance, where he's in a life and death struggle with other Native Americans, other American Indians. So this is, again, it's such a complicated story with so many threads that that's what got left out of our school book version. And I'm reminded, of course, that John Adams said facts are stubborn things. And it's interesting because Adams, I raise his name because he is one of the eight presidents who are descendants of the Mayflower. Both Adamses and both Bushes claim descent from the Mayflower. So this is all a very tentative thing, but when that October 1621 finally rolls around, there's been tremendous death, but they're now beginning to be seen the hopes of a future and settlement and now resupply as well. More ships are going to come, bringing more settlers, a few at first, but this is going to be the beginning of a great migration into New England by first Pilgrims and later Puritans.
So is there a sort of an event or moment or even time from which this story of the Thanksgiving feast comes from at this point?
Well, let's talk about the Thanksgiving feast, I suppose, for just a minute, because it wasn't November, obviously. That is an idea that comes along much later. What the Pilgrims celebrated in October of 1621 was a harvest festival, not a novel idea. Every civilization in history practically has had some kind of harvest festival, harvest celebration, being grateful for bringing in the crops and looking forward to the harvest. Theirs lasted 3 days. We think we spend a lot of time at the dinner table on Thanksgiving Day. They had a 3-day feast. 90 of those local warriors, the Wampanoag, do show up unexpectedly with their chief Massasoit. They go out and kill 5 deer, so there's fresh venison. In addition, we should lay it out here. Yes, there was turkey, but it was wild turkey. There was a lot more seafood, oysters, mussels, cod. There were ducks and geese. They had plenty of things they had grown, including cucumbers, and they did eat cranberries, but not as cranberry sauce. They would have eaten them raw in a salad, what they would have called a salette. So a very different feast from what we might be expecting. They would have eaten in their wooden bowls that were called trenchers. It was a bowl on one side and flat on the other. And 3 days, as I said, of feasting, but also games and wrestling and races, and then a show of musketry as well, which probably was a little bit of we have these weapons and we know how to use them, you know, that kind of show. So that was what the true first Thanksgiving was. And we know about this because William Bradford, who was on the Mayflower and later the governor of Plymouth, records this in his first written account of the Plymouth plantation.
And so how do we get from that account to a national holiday?
It's a long process that changes a great deal over several centuries. What happened was that the idea of Founders Day became established in New England, and Founders Day was much more along the lines of what we think of as Thanksgiving. When we get to presidents declaring days of Thanksgiving, Washington and the Congress do it during the American Revolution, but it's to be grateful for the victory in at the Battle of Saratoga. Washington, as president, declares a Thanksgiving to celebrate the Constitution. And the first presidential Thanksgiving proclamation is really related to the passage of a Constitution. By the way, when he calls for a day of Thanksgiving, he calls for a day of prayer. And it's much more solemn. This is it's not a day of celebration at all, and certainly no reference to Pilgrims, Mayflowers, and settling New England. A couple of other presidents issued Thanksgiving proclamations. Madison does one after the conclusion of the War of 1812, But as we know it today, Thanksgiving became established when Lincoln makes a Thanksgiving proclamation in October 1863 to be celebrated in November of 1863. And this is considered the first of an unbroken string of national presidential proclamations. By that time, different states had begun to celebrate Thanksgiving as this idea of a Founders' Day. But it still wasn't the national day celebrating this foundation myth or legend that we have of the Pilgrims until much later.
All right, we'll talk about how that myth develops over time. Let's go to the phones, though, first to Mike in Bangor. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the passengers all being kept below decks. My wife and I were on the Mayflower, too, several years ago, and of course, the crew members are role-playing and not recognizing anything that happened after that date in 1621. And one of the other visitors to the Mayflower walked up and said to a crewman we were standing there, where did you keep the animals? And he said, well, madam, we kept the animals below decks. And she said, no, the passengers. He says, hi, madam, we kept the animals below decks. And she said, no, the cows and the horses. He says, oh, the stock were kept in the hold. And apparently that's the whole attitude that the crew had, because I assume that's authentically researched, that they were just a necessary evil to the voyage. I just wanted to share that.
Yeah. Very, very much true. And, of course, you can go. The Plymouth Plantation, of course, is a wonderful site. And I'm a big proponent when people ask me about, how do I get my kids interested in history? Or teachers ask me, what do I do to get my kids more involved? I'm a big proponent of the field trip approach. I think when you take kids to these places and they see and smell it and feel it, it becomes more real. And there is, of course, a replica of what we think the Mayflower looked like that one can get on. I had a memorable trip there recently with my wife. We were standing and also below decks, and it's very, very low and kind of close and dark, and some young boys who must have been in the sixth grade are standing beside us, and my wife happened to be chewing some gum, and one boy says to the other, wow, I smell gum. Do you think the Pilgrims had gum? And indeed they did not. Their rations on board were pretty meager. Oatmeal, porridge, dried beans, dried peas that would have been reconstituted, dried prunes that would have been reconstituted, which also reminds me that bathing and latrine facilities were very limited on the Mayflower as well. There were slop buckets, and that was about it.
Right. Jim in South Gardner. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if there had been any awareness on the part of those on the Mayflower of the Popham colony up here on the Midcoast, if they had learned any lessons from that very short expedition and any awareness of it.
There was awareness of everything that had happened, and we have to again remember that these people were not coming into some completely unknown, uncharted territory. But Captain John Smith, we remember that name well from Virginia, and he's draped in enough legend myth as well, much of it self-created, had really sailed up to New England and mapped the area, mapped the coast very well. So that experience and all of the others were well known to the people we call the Pilgrims, largely because this was not just a group of people deciding to set off on their own. This was a joint stock venture. This was an investment by men in London who wanted to make sure there was a return on their investment. So all of this had been researched to a degree, but the fact that these people ended up in Massachusetts, what we now call Massachusetts, as opposed to Virginia, has been the subject of some, you know, debate over the centuries. Did they deliberately avoid going to Virginia because they wanted to stay outside of Virginia's control? And the answer to that is widely assumed to be yes.
And of course, Samoset, as we talked about, the first Indian to kind of wander into the Pilgrim camp, came from a tribe in Maine and had hooked up with an explorer who'd been through that part.
That's correct. And again, this speaks to this idea that this was not uncharted territory. This was familiar territory to certainly some Europeans. But what changes, of course, is that this first settlement then becomes a springboard for a decades-long emigration, and this later, in a few years, will become the great Puritan emigration. And it's when the Puritans come and start to settle what eventually becomes Boston and becomes the Massachusetts Bay Colony, that the nature of the colony changes, and the nature of the relationship with those Indians really changes. As we mentioned and alluded to already, 1621, they're sitting down to enjoy this festive three-day celebration together. But by 1676, they are at war in one of the most brutal and deadly wars of the colonial period, known as King Philip's War.
All right, and we'll take a quick break. When we come back, more of the true story of Thanksgiving. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Hebron Academy, developing critical thinking and communication skills for life. More at hebronacademy.org. And Finance Authority of Maine, committed to expanding business and education opportunities by investing in Mainers' success. FameMaine.com.
What good is sitting?
That's a 1965 demo recording of the title song from the musical Cabaret, performed by the songwriters John Kander and Fred Ebb, who also wrote the songs for Chicago, Flora the Red Menace, and the Scottsboro Boys. On the next Fresh Air, I'll talk with Kander about his new double CD, Hidden Treasures. Join us.
Put down your knitting. Your
tune into Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock. And coming up in just about 20 minutes on Speaking in Maine, we'll go next to USM for a panel discussion moderated by MPBN's own Jennifer Rooks on the role of religion in conflicts and how religion can be a positive or negative force in the society. Panel will be made up of religious leaders in the Christian, Jewish, and Muslim faith. That's coming up at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, things you may not have known about Thanksgiving. In our Bangor studio, author Ken Davis. And we invite you to join the conversation as well. The number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Bruce in Brunswick. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I enjoy the show. I wish I had started listening earlier today. I've missed part of it here, but I was wondering if you had touched on the specifics about the rock. My father-in-law actually was one of the people who sailed in on the shallop when the Mayflower II was delivered in Plymouth, and there's all kinds of great stories. This is just one of them where they hauled the rock up into the center of town, and then people started chipping away at it, taking chunks home for souvenirs. So the rock that's there in the cage is much smaller. At some point, someone said, we better get this thing in a protective place so that it doesn't disappear on us.
Yeah, Ken Davis, there's this question really about whether they actually landed on the rock.
Well, of course, as Malcolm X said, the rock didn't. They didn't land on the rock. The rock landed on us. No, there was no reference of a rock in any of the early accounts. The first time it's really become celebrated is more than 120 years later, and somebody says that his grandfather and great grandfather was on the boat, and he remembers there. So this rock really becomes ensconced in local legend and lore without any documentary evidence. Of course, a lot of kids who go up and see Plymouth Rock are kind of less than impressed at this, you know, little stone that's got this wrought iron fence around it. So no real reference to the Plymouth Rock, but it became a great tourist attraction, especially in the later 19th century, when this myth, this foundation legend, really becomes so much a part of the American story. It's really around the late 19th century that the whole pilgrim story and New England and the survival story and the foundation story really becomes so established, not only in New England lore, but in American lore as the beginning of the country, even though obviously the Spanish had been here a lot longer and the Virginians were down there as well. I should also mention briefly that 50 years before the Mayflower sailed, there were first pilgrims, people who came for religious freedom, in Florida. They were French, Huguenots, and they were there for about a year until the Spanish realized they were there, and the king sent a fleet over to get rid of them. And that was the reason that St. Augustine was established 450 years ago, and it led to a massacre of the French by the Spanish, and it was not done because they were French, but because they were Protestant. So 50 years before the Mayflower sails, we're fighting over religion in the future of America, leading to a tremendous religious bloodbath and sectarian warfare that really does continue for a long time in our history, and this is one of the important parts of this story that has been forgotten, that when we talk about this idea of pilgrims coming for religious freedom, that usually meant their own freedom, not somebody else's. And especially this conflict and strife between Spanish Catholics, later French Catholics, and Protestant Englishmen was very, very pronounced in this country for much of our history. And it's something we don't talk enough about.
All right, let's go to Becky in Lincolnville. Hi, Becky. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. So I kind of came in a little late. Did you talk about the Great Dying Off?
The Great Dying Off. Do you mean of the Native Americans?
Right, right before the Pilgrims landed, there was the Great Dying Off.
Yes, that's one of the things we did discuss, the fact that whole villages had been emptied out by epidemic diseases introduced most likely by European fishermen, sailors, traders who had been here earlier.
This would be tuberculosis.
Smallpox was one of the great killers. We're not even sure which disease swept through New England at that time, but that was a pattern that only continued, especially as the Puritans arrive, and the Puritans' account shows, the later account, John Winthrop, for instance, talks about whole villages being wiped out by disease, and he attributes it to God's blessing on the Puritans for coming to this land that's being opened up to them by this disease wiping out. And certainly that's also part of the reason for King Philip's War in 1676. The native people are seeing their lands taken from them. They're seeing their people die off in unbelievable numbers. And so this was a war, in essence, for survival.
Yeah.
So, what interested me is that Abigail Adams actually had her family inoculated with smallpox in a very primitive way by just transferring pus to cuts.
That's true.
Do you happen to know if that was an Indian thing, or who thought that up?
No, the idea of smallpox vaccinations comes along a little bit later, although certainly it begins during the Puritan period, the idea that you introduce a mild form of a disease. And John Adams himself was a large proponent of it. So was George Washington. Of course, we're talking about a much later period in American history now. But for instance, during the American Revolution, many more people died from smallpox than died from fighting in the American Revolution, including many in Boston during the time that the British were occupying. But now we're getting into a much later period in our history. But this element and this importance of things like disease in our history often gets forgotten because we get so tied up with dates and battles and speeches and laws that we forget about this human side of the story. And disease was a major factor in the whole exploration, discovery, and ultimately the decimation of the Native American population, not only in New England, but throughout both continents of the Americas.
Let's go to Mia in Brunswick. Hi, Mia.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for the program. I'm wondering, I have heard that a possible origin of the official celebration of Thanksgiving has to do with the massacre of 700 Pequots in 1637. And during their green corn dance, and apparently at that time the governor of Massachusetts declared a Thanksgiving Day and a special holiday to celebrate the massacre.
I've never seen that. Thank you. That's an interesting idea. I certainly refer to that period, and again, this was well after the first Thanksgiving, when relations between the colonists, the English colonists, and the American Indian tribes throughout New England had really begun to deteriorate. And we have William Bradford's account, for instance, of that massacre, and he talks about the villages burning and the blood flowing through the streets, and that it was a sweet smell of sacrifice to God. So a very different change. I've never seen a specific connection between that and Thanksgiving. The idea, again, of Thanksgivings were for any great event, and later on in American history, as I mentioned, we have them for the Revolution and the Constitution and the War of 1812. And finally, Lincoln sets that date. He makes it the last Thursday in November, and interestingly, that gets changed a little bit, most famously by Franklin D. Roosevelt.
We only have a couple of minutes left here. Let's go to Chris briefly in Belfast. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Thanks for having this program. I have spent many years as a supporter of the political issues of the Wampanoag in Massachusetts, along with other Indian people, and spent a lot of Thanksgivings down in Plymouth with them. And I just wondered, the first thing I wanted to say is, clear up one thing, is that Massasoit, that was his title.
That's a title, yes.
He was the supreme sachem of what were known as the Pokanoket at that time. And his real name was Osamequin, which meant yellow feather. He was the father of King Philip. But what my understanding of the first Thanksgiving really has to do with the 1621, earlier than what you're talking about, was the massacre of Wittawamat and Pexawatt and his company, who were actually members of the Massachusetts Nation. And they got involved because the boat that showed up after the Mayflower was a man named Captain Weston, and
We've got a minute left, so real quick.
Yeah, well, it's just that Miles Standish, Wittawamat was, and his company were trying to drive the English out of that area, and Miles Standish engineered a bit of treachery to giving him a promising self. Safe conduct, and then ended up massacring these Indians and putting his head on a pole outside of the Plymouth colony. And basically,
right, which we're going to have to cut you off there because we're really out of time. But that's sort of a lasting image, isn't it?
That is the complexity of these stories. I tried to allude to it earlier that the English were allied with one tribe and there were other tribes, and it was a bloody conflict from the very beginning. And of course, he mentions a head on a pole, and that happened. Eventually, King Philip, who is Massasoit's son, better known as Metacom, also King Philip, his head is also put on a pole after this brutal war in 1676.
Kind of runs against the image we have of the games and the feast
and the happy pilgrims sitting right. down with the happy Indians and everyone enjoying a good day together.
Yeah. Kenneth Davis, thank you so much for being
Facts
here.
Facts are stubborn things.
Thank you so much. Best-selling author of Don't Know Much About History. His latest book is The Hidden History of America at War. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today, and you can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcast by visiting mainecalling.net. If you came in late to this show, just go onto our website and listen to it there. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. From all of us here at MPBN and Maine Calling, have a happy Thanksgiving.